Can a survey change the future? Maybe this one can. Cannabis education is inconsistent at best and missing or misleading at worst. How can we make cannabis education better? What if we ask people who use or are thinking about using cannabis a bunch of questions? What if we ask pharmacists who could be teaching people about cannabis a bunch of questions? And then, what if the answers from those questions were used to help pharmacists teach people about cannabis better? Well, this is exactly what pharmacists as cannabis educators, or PACE, are doing. And PACE needs you to fill out a survey. PACE needs as many people as possible to fill out a survey. PACE needs you to fill out a survey on or before May 12th. This is a limited time offer for you to help change the future of cannabis education. To participate, go to promo.reefermed.ca. That's promo, promo.reefermed.ca.
It's Reefer Madness, the podcast, with Trevor and Kirk.
Kirk, one of the pharmacists I've worked with just sent around a Health Canada warning that I think you'll like.
Okay.
So now it's a little bit older, but she just sent it around last week. From September 2019, gabapentin and pregabalin, when mixed with opioids, increase the chance of opioid overdose.
That's new knowledge?
Well, it's a new Health Canada warning.
haven't we known that for a while?
Well, Health Canada is now warning us that you mix gabapentin and opioids, you're more likely to die from an opioid overdose.
Gabapentins. We're going to talk about gabapentins. Reefer Madness, the podcast. I'm Kirk Nyquist. I am a registered nurse in Manitoba, Canada.
I'm Trevor Schufelt. I'm the pharmacist. And right now we're sitting in City of Sunshine, Dauphin, Manitoba.
Yeah, on a beautiful, beautiful, hazy Sunday morning in the professional studios of CKDM Radio.
So the next guy we're going to interview, Dr. Ian Mitchell. I've seen a few things on him, but one that stands out is a picture of him and a whole group of people sticking their fingers in their ears, looking like they're all doing a silent scream.
You know what? I will confess, I listened to this interview this morning, and I was wondering about that. I didn't quite hear.
So,
gabapentin, we're talking about gabapentin.
Right. Now, this one is, we like rabbit holes. This was a rabbit hole. So this is not strictly the cannabis part of the interview. We do a, so the main part of the interview is basically gabapentin versus cannabis. And that's interesting.
About this, 5 minutes of the interview was that.
Yeah.
But, which is fine. It's a good 5 minutes. And I'm sorry I'm stepping on you. I like this interview. We only spend about 5 minutes on the cannabis component, but stick with us because we tear apart gabapentin.
Yeah. So we do talk about cannabis, but the silent scream is just another really fascinating chemical that Dr. Mitchell is dealing with called ketamine. Ketamine, ketamine. Okay, and it's not just for horses anymore. And that one was, those were all practitioners in the room, and he was teaching them something called a Larsen maneuver to open up your vocal cords if they've seized when you were given too much ketamine in, say, an emergency room. But we'll let him talk about that.
Yeah, and I want to say, I don't use ketamine in my practice, right? And now but in my practice, I work in rural, I work in remote stations, so we deal with a lot of medevacs. And when the medevac team comes in, ketamine is part of their practice and they use it. So I've seen it used. I don't use it in my practice. So can you?
Well, I do.
Yes.
Which is strange when you think about it. I'm not injecting. I'm not spraying it up anyone's noses. We use it in topical pain relief for neuropathic pain. So you've got that sciatic nerve pain. You've got that postherpetic neuralgia. We use it topically in a cream because it's an NMDA receptor antagonist, which lots of letters. There are different ways, different pain pathways to get stuff up to the brain. And most drugs, like all the opioids, save for maybe methadone, don't block the NMDA receptor. Don't spill your coffee.
And might as well make it obvious. Okay.
But ketamine does. So, you know, whereas someone, we could give them a boatload of morphine and it won't affect their postherpetic neuralgia. In some cases, we put a ketamine cream on it and it does dull that pain quite a bit. So ketamine.
Yeah. So what class of drug is it?
So, yeah, it's a lot of things, but it's probably
a lot of things.
A lot of things, okay. But it's probably most regularly known as a dissociative anesthetic.
Okay. And it helps. It basically, when people get ketamine, is it like Versed in the sense that when you get it, your memory is gone? Or is it just strictly pain management, or did it just put you to sleep? I have ketamine and I go to sleep, do I still feel the pain? I guess that's what I'm asking.
My understanding is no. So call it more the pain end of things. It makes you not aware of the pain or takes you somewhere else.
Okay.
And we'll let Dr. Mitchell get more into it. There's some other really fascinating things they're doing with ketamine, and I had him on the phone. I couldn't resist asking him about what else they're doing.
Okay. So, but also, and I think this is important that we talk about this before we get into his interview. Let's talk about Gabby's.
Gabby's. So we'll start with you because I know how much you like the Gabby's. Kirk, how much do you like the Gabby's up north?
I don't like gabapentin. And again, if you go back to our earliest episodes, I talk a lot about gabapentin as a drug that my understanding of it. Now, I'm not a pharmacist, and in my practice, I know a fair bit about certain medications that I am allowed to prescribe through protocol. And some medications I do not prescribe, and I do not have a lot of attention to. But Gabby's are not within my scope of practice, so I cannot prescribe it in my scope of practice.
Any of your patients on it?
Oh, gosh. What is it? Like, I think it's the 14th most prescribed drug in America. I don't know what it is in Canada.
It's up there.
It's used in diabetic neuropathies. It's used for anxiety. It's used for all these things.
I lump it generally under neuropathic or nerve-related pain, which honest people gets back to cannabis because
we're going to get to cannabis.
We will get to cannabis.
But I want to bash Gabby's for a while. What angers me or gets me upset or gets me into my debating moves and posturing is gabapentin is used by the medical field off label. What does that mean, Trevor? When somebody is using a medication off label?
So on label, we call it has an indication. That means, you know, it's gone through rigorous testing saying that we have X number of studies saying this drug will treat this condition under these circumstances. You know, you use this dose of that drug and your blood pressure goes down this many points. Off-label is basically if you use it for anything else.
So please expand on that, Trevor. How is gabapentin? What is gabapentin first designed for?
Okay, so I wrote it down, so make sure I get this right. So gabapentin mimics the neurotransmitter GABA, G-A-B-A, but it doesn't actually affect the GABA or the GABA receptors, which was always a trick question in psychopharmacology. It inhibits the alpha 2 delta subunit of voltage gated calcium channels. So it was originally marketed as a seizure medication. Like anything that has seizures, give them gabapentin, will work. Problem was, it wasn't particularly good at that. So, and Dr. Mitchell gets more into this so he can be your new hero. Park Davis then said, well, if it's not a really good seizure medication, what else could we sell it for? And lately it's been just about everything. And to give doctors their due, nerve pain is hard to treat. Neuropathic pain is hard to treat. So when we have, you know, patients in the office complaining of pain, none of the three or four other things you've thrown at it have helped. Usually at some point gabapentin comes out, let's try this.
Well, and again, in my practice, and I don't know exactly, but in my practice, around 2001, 2004, the early 2000s, fibromyalgia.
Yeah.
It became the thing. Now, I apologize for those people out there that if you had it in the 90s or the 80s, but in my practice, that's when I started seeing this stuff. And a lot of the medical practitioners I was working with didn't recognize it as a legitimate issue. It was all psychological.
Well, it is still a diagnosis of exclusion. If you can't figure out what else is wrong with someone, it's fibromyalgia.
And so a differential diagnosis, that's how I refer to it. And another rabbit hole. Sometimes doctors don't tell you what you have. What the doctors do is they tell you what you don't have. You don't have this, you don't have this, you don't have this. So the differential diagnosis is it must be this, right? So fibromyalgia became this thing, and all of a sudden gabapentin is coming in as the cure-all.
And we're just going to stop right there before we get all the angry emails. All of you out there who have fibromyalgia suffer from it, we are not denigrating.
No.
We know you have real pain. We're talking about doctors. Doctors have a condition that didn't exist a little while ago. It suddenly exists, and suddenly there's gabapentin.
Now there's gabapentin. But there was no studies done on gabapentins to say that gabapentin will work on fibromyalgia or neuropathic pain.
No, that's the definition of off-label.
Right. So, but doctors started prescribing it. Now, in my practice, it's a hugely abused substance, right? You get it, and doctors are dealing this stuff out. And I say dealing, and again, it's just, I'm a nurse. I believe in holistic practices. I don't believe in just giving somebody something because they want it. However, I'll get to that in a minute. However, I've been in that situation, so I get it. But gabapentin is a drug that doctors use and are comfortable with. But when you get into a conversation with doctors about cannabis, what's the first thing they'll tell you?
No studies.
No studies. So I go to them and say, so why are you using gabapentin? Off-label. When there's no studies. And Parks Davis got sued hugely for misadvertising. And you're still using gabapentins. So what I think is really cool, we got this emergency doctor who's also a cannabis researcher, which I'd like to know more about as I was listening to it. I'd like to know where he does his research. Did he talk to you about that, where he does his research?
Really briefly. He's yet another guy that knows so much, he's probably two or three interviews.
Yeah, no. So he's an emerge doc out of Kamloops, and he doesn't like Gabby. I felt like we should walk.
You got vindicated.
I had a friend in him. I wanted to walk down the road with him hand in hand about gabapentins, because I've been screaming about gabapentins, the use of it, and in the comparison of cannabis, because I don't believe gabapentins being used properly, but yet doctors are very comfortable with it. Now, I will go back to my comment about doctors, and Dr. Either you mentioned it or Dr. Mitchell mentioned it. Sometimes patients just want something to feel like they have been treated.
Right.
Right. Now, I'm in my practice, I can, again, following protocols, ensuring that my assessment is correct, so that I don't anger anybody out there, I can go and choose an antibiotic for an infection, right? So if you have a skin infection, I use a specific type, a Keflex or a cephalosporin. And if you have a bladder infection, I might use something else, a nitrofurantoin, right? So I have to have that knowledge. So sometimes patients will come in with a viral infection, an upper respiratory cough, a cold, and they want an antibiotic. And I have to sit and talk to them about...
It's not going to work.
It's not going to work. Right. So, but they want to walk away with something. So I understand, and I've had these conversations with medical practitioners. Sometimes they will just prescribe something to get the person out of their office. Now, I'm not a doctor. I've had these conversations. It is hearsay, but I know what happens. And I think Gabby's is one of those drugs that sometimes they just say, enough. Here's your 60. You get 60 a month. Get out of my office.
Well, and to give the doctors their due, I'm sure there is that, but there is also the doctors are rightfully being told to prescribe way less opioids. Well, so again, you literally have a patient in pain in your office, and you know this whole class of drugs you're being told not to prescribe, and the patient wants something. They are in legitimate pain. I don't know if...
Cannabis!
Well, I was going to say, ignoring cannabis for the moment, I don't know if your regular GP has a whole lot of other options. And as we discussed a little in the interview, which we should probably get to, referrals to pain clinics can take years.
Yeah. You know, and again, we have this doctor, and please ensure that when you quote me on what I've said, you reference it in context of cannabis. When I bash gabapentin and I bash practitioners that overprescribe it, I'm doing it in the context that cannabis is becoming, or is, in Dr. Mitchell's case, is
an alternative.
Well, I didn't want to use the word alternative, Trevor, because when you say alternative, it means that the other choice is there. I don't think Gabby's is a choice for neuropathic pain. Now, some people get relief, but is it the placebo effect? You know,
with pain, it's always hard to tell.
I know.
But you know what?
I know.
We'll argue more at the end. Let's let an actual expert teach us something.
It's a good one. Thank you. Yeah.
It's Reefer Madness, the podcast.
Good morning. Thanks. So my name is Ian Mitchell. I am an emergency physician in Kamloops, British Columbia. I work at the Royal Inland Hospital. And I am also a cannabis researcher. I study the effects of cannabis on PTSD in a study going on at UBC Okanagan. I am associate clinical professor of emergency medicine at the University of British Columbia. I started off my career at St. Paul's Hospital and worked there for a number of years, serving the population of the downtown east side, and kind of took some of that attitude and research up to Kamloops, where we became the first emergency department in Canada to distribute naloxone kits to anyone who had suffered an opiate overdose. I'm now moving into, obviously, into the, still in the cannabis field as an authorizer of cannabis prescriptions. And I'm kind of getting active in the ketamine sphere as far as treating treatment-resistant depression, as emergency physicians are one of the biggest users of ketamine overall. And I'm now kind of taking that research to see what we can do outside of pain management.
Wow. So many interesting things there. But the main reason we called you today is you had a talk and an article about gabapentin sort of versus cannabis, which was really interesting. And as a pharmacist, that caught my eye immediately. So I'm going to ask you questions about that. But how about we'll start off up front. Gabapentin. So for our listeners who've never heard of it before, what's gabapentin and what do we do with it normally?
So gabapentin is a medication that is generally recommended for nerve pain. It's been around for a long time, and it's still one of the most commonly prescribed medications for pain. It's actually becoming more and more widely used now that physicians are more reluctant to prescribe opiate medications such as morphine and OxyContin.
Yeah, and in the pharmacy today, I definitely dispense two or three prescriptions of gabapentin today. So yes, absolutely, it is common. Now, in pharmacy school, they told me that gabapentin was sort of originally they're trying to do it as a seizure medication, but it didn't work all that well. I know in your talk you had a little bit about the history. So how did we get to gabapentin being used?
Yeah, so gabapentin was, I believe, invented by Park Davis. And boy, Park Davis are like the party people of the pharma world. They used to distribute cannabis and cocaine. They invented ketamine and PCP. And they also invented gabapentin, which also turns out to be a drug of abuse. So Park Davis invented gabapentin. And originally, as you say, it was approved for seizure disorders. But they quickly realized that that's not where the money is. You need to get out and get it approved for lots of different things. So initially, they were involved with a lot of very dubious research. They published some positive studies and they hid the negative studies. One of their main researchers on gabapentin was later imprisoned for falsifying data from research studies and completely fabricating data. So the whole kind of literature base that supports gabapentin is basically supported by criminal enterprise.
Wow.
And this was compounded by Park Davis's marketing after that of gabapentin, where they had big payoffs to doctors who were prescribing, and they were marketing gabapentin for conditions which they knew it didn't work, which it wasn't approved for. They were marketing it to children. They were marketing it to seniors, people it was not approved for at all. As a result of this mismarketing, they were fined almost $500 million in fines, which is one of the largest fines ever levied against a pharmaceutical company. Still kind of chump change for considering what they made off gabapentin over the years they had it on patent.
We can go into it more later, but just to give our audience an idea, like gabapentin is, like you said, really common, and now with opioid scares, it become even more common. Like if you go see your doctor and you have a migraine that they can't treat another way, some sort of shooting pain down your leg they can't treat another way, like anything that's quote-unquote neuropathic, gabapentin's probably the top two or three drugs that your family physician's probably going to try throwing at it first. So it's used all the time.
It's used all the time. It's actually the number one recommended medication for nerve pain. If you look at the algorithms from Canadian Pain Society, Canadian Family Practice, they're strongly advocating the use of gabapentin. The problem is that we now have much better literature. We found the hidden studies. We know that gabapentin is probably more likely to harm you than to help you. Looking at the numbers needed to treat, the side effect profile is very poor for gabapentin. So we're stuck with this medication that's still being widely recommended. And unfortunately, because of the whole opiate thing, physicians have nothing else to offer patients. So gabapentin is being thrown out there just to kind of see if it works. And you shouldn't get me wrong. There are some patients that gabapentin works for. It's probably about 1 in 8, 1 in 9. We say number needed to treat. So number of people you need to treat for someone to actually have a reasonable clinical outcome, a reasonable improvement. That's probably about 1 or 8 in 1 in 9. So it's not zero, but it's nowhere near what people are thinking that it's as good as. And that's kind of a difficult thing to say to patients. Well, you know, we've got this terrible nerve pain. Here's this medication that will more likely harm you than help you. And if you're one of the lucky, you know, 1 in 8 people, terrific, try that. It's just not a very promising message for patients.
Okay, and now sort of on the other side, something that I know the Canadian Medical Association's come out against, and frankly, my College of Pharmacy and Kirk's College of Nursing, cannabis. How does cannabis sort of stack up versus gabapentin for some of these nerve-related pain things?
Well, so when we talk about neuropathic pain, cannabis has similar or probably better profile for helping. The limited studies we have, and the thing is, there's very limited studies because they haven't been permitted. It's not been allowed to do studies in America on looking at the benefits of cannabis. You could say the harms all you want, but you're not able to get research money or research cannabis to study any benefits. So we don't have any studies from America for that. We've got 1 or 2 studies from Canada that showed benefit in neuropathic pain.
And I'm going to jump in before we keep going down that one. You mentioned in your talk that you thought it was harder to research cannabis now post-legalization than it was before. Did I read that right?
That is correct, yeah. And you can see that in the literature right now that while there's projects being announced, there's very little being published. And that's because it takes Health Canada so long to approve the process. So the barriers have actually increased to the point where now people are taking cannabis research to America to do it. Not because they can get research dry herb, but they can get extracts there and they can do research on extracts. When we have got extracts here, but the research process is so tiresome, so burdensome, that people just aren't able to get it done.
That's crazy. Okay, so from the limited data we have on cannabis and we'll call it nerve-related pain, neuropathic pain, what do we know about how cannabis works on what we're finding gabapentin isn't so good at?
So I think what we're generally looking at chronic pain here. So it's pain that's ongoing for longer than a couple of days. And I don't know that I could say that cannabis is necessarily good treatment for acute pain. We don't have that data yet. But for chronic pain, it seems to be as good, certainly better than gabapentin. And that's not just neuropathic pain. That's for all manners of pain. So I would say that it's likely more effective, has fewer side effects. But because of the stigma, it's ranked far lower than medications have significantly more harm, like gabapentin, like Tramacet, which I could go on a whole other podcast about.
Yeah, no, Tramacet is not my favorite either. Around here, honestly, it's just on price, but we'll leave that alone for the moment. But so for pain, because there's so many different things in cannabis, you know, we've got the two that everyone's heard about, the THC and the CBD, then we have probably 100 minor cannabinoids, then we have terpenes. Do we have any idea what parts of cannabis is good for pain, or is that still an open question?
I would say that's open question. I think we don't have good evidence that CBD is analgesic, that CBD relieves pain. I think we can say that CBD is likely anti-inflammatory and it's anti-anxiety, and those are qualities of pain that can be helpful. But if you're looking at the heavy lifting for pain, particularly neuropathic pain, it's THC, and that's really what the studies are looking at. So the challenge then is to deliver THC in a way that people are still capable of going about their business and not being impaired. And often that comes by combining the THC with the CBD. So for the patients that I treat who have neuropathic pain, generally I'm recommending a nighttime product of THC and CBD. I always invite people to try just plain CBD during the day first off, just to see if that is enough to manage their pain and help get them through there, just because I feel that's very safe. But okay, ultimately, they need some THC during the day. And then if they're doing that, then we talk a little bit about impairment and, you know, microdosing and how they can manage to deal with their pain and still be able to do what they want to do during the day.
Okay. And because I'm a pharmacist and semi-obsessed with this, how are you getting this into patients? Are you telling them to vape it or take an oil because they can change the dose, a capsule? Do you have any thoughts that way?
So generally, I'm not a big fan of smoking. I don't think doctors are generally fans of smoking. So I am happy enough people vape dry herb, but most of my patients nowadays, my population tends to run between 60 and 80. So they're just not smokers. They don't want to vape. So they're really taking the oils. And that's the number one product I'm looking at with patients right now. And they're starting off predominantly at nighttime. So they kind of build up some tolerance and then they will start to bring some of that into the day.
And anecdotally seems to be going okay with the patients that you're using?
You know, I've had some terrific response. I don't expect to make everybody better, but no, I have people that, you know, they come and say I've changed their lives in a more frequent way than I do in emergency medicine, which is a bit of a different feeling. But I've certainly had great success with treating people with nerve pain, and certainly they've also been able to come off their opiates and their gabapentin, and that's often something we address with their visits ongoing is, you know, they may want to start tapering down some of their other medications.
Okay. And sorry, jumping back to gabapentin a bit, because I don't think we touched on it earlier. Gabapentin, you know, mainstream bodies are promoting it as, you know, a cure-all for many, many things, but they don't talk often about the abuse potential of gabapentin. Do you want to touch on that?
Absolutely. So it is... It's not the most widely abused drug, but we certainly understand that it can be abused. One of the things we know is it increases the effects of opiates and also increases the death rate associated with opiates. So if you're taking the two together, you're more likely to die. But on its own, it can produce a high, and it's kind of a poor man's high to take. But so that's kind of come up, and we perceive that a lot more, particularly in the prison population, people really requesting gabapentin. I can't see, I say, a lot of overdose from it, but Lyrica has become very popular as a drug abuse, particularly in the United Kingdom, and has been rescheduled as a consequence.
And that surprised me when I read that in your talk. Again, maybe it shouldn't have, but a lot of the physicians in my area anyway are kind of steering clear of gabapentin when they can, because of some of the things that have been coming up about it, but they've been switching instead to Lyrica or pregabalin. So I take it you're implying that's not necessarily a good switch.
I would say the abuse potential is probably higher. It seems we've certainly heard more about Lyrica abuse than gabapentin abuse. But I would say it's mostly the more expensive form of gabapentin. There's still no evidence that it works any better than gabapentin did, although it probably does have fewer side effects. But I think there's also this concern you mentioned about, you know, doctors going away from gabapentin and coming back to it. It is just prescribed for everything these days. Alcohol withdrawal, benzodiazepine withdrawal, chronic pain, acute pain, arthritis, painful periods. You know, I think one of the criticisms that the Canadian Medical Association sometimes has is that people say, well, cannabis cures everything. And, you know, that's exactly what's going on with gabapentin. Gabapentin appears to cure everything. And you know that from how many prescriptions you fill for it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's that sounds bad, but it's given out like Tic Tacs around here. And I'm not disparaging my local doctors. I think they're doing the best they can with the tools they have. But yes, if we can't figure out what kind of pain it is, usually gabapentin is tried with it sooner or later.
Yeah, and that kind of brings up, I don't know, maybe an uncomfortable thought about, you know, doctor-patient relationship. Is like, you know, when people want something and they kind of, you know, if they don't have something, they feel that they, you know, haven't been treated, or, you know, that's they haven't received proper medical care. So, you know, is this just a placebo, something to give people and hope it works? And it may, but realistically, if we all know that it doesn't work, how can you keep on conscious prescribing it?
No, fair enough. And while that goes down, like you said, a whole other different podcast, and to, you know, be nice if we had easier access to places like pain clinics when, you know, the GP has sort of run out of everything in her bag of tricks and wants to try something else. Around here, anyway, it can easily take a year more to get them into a pain clinic to try something else.
Yeah, and then that's absolutely the same case with where I work. There's very limited access to pain facilities. So without those, people are just going to their doctor, and it used to be they would get lots of opiates, and now they're getting lots of gabapentin. It's just, and it's not the most harmful thing, but it's not really helpful either. And you can see that, you know, as opiate prescribing has gone down, gabapentin prescribing has gone way up, even as more and more studies show it's ineffective. And there's good research showing that doctors who take more money from pharmaceutical companies are much more likely to prescribe Lyrica, you know, the upmarket version. They're much more likely to prescribe brand name versions of gabapentin.
Okay, for something completely different, because I think we have time to slide this in. So we're normally a cannabis podcast, but there was a really interesting picture of you in front of a large group of people. And everybody seemed to be yawning and sticking their fingers in their ears. What was that about?
So I was teaching about ketamine to a group of practitioners who are interested in using it for treatment-resistant depression. And this is a kind of relatively new thing, although the FDA just approved a form of ketamine nasal inhaler for treatment of ketamine of treatment-resistant depression in the U.S. Now, I give ketamine in much larger doses in the emergency department, and occasionally that can cause laryngospasm, which is where your vocal cords spasm up and close off your airway, which is a pretty dramatic and unsettling thing to have happen, because then people can't breathe. And so if you do this maneuver where you stick the fingers on both sides and kind of push towards the center, that both causes pain and clears the airway and can clear up that laryngospasm. So that was just an opportunity for a great picture and a great conference I was at.
No, and like I said, normally cannabis, but I'll pick your brain a little bit more about this. So we're a compounding pharmacy, so when I use ketamine, I'm probably putting it in a cream that someone's going to rub on some neuropathic pain. How is ketamine... And maybe we should have, I'll do both. If you can tell the audience what ketamine is usually used for, and like anesthetics, and then how do we think it might be doing something for depression?
Absolutely. So yeah, ketamine, as you say, is a dissociative anesthetic, kind of makes people just go away for a little while. A lot of people are familiar with it as a horse tranquilizer. That's kind of what I often hear it referred to. But I give it to children for procedures. So I gave it to a boy last night to fix a fractured arm.
An injection you're giving him?
So I'm giving this intravenously.
Okay.
So what, and that's really the use that people are familiar with. But right now in British Columbia, ambulances now carry nasal inhalers of ketamine for acute pain management. And that's a result of a study that was done by a guy called Gary Andolfato, who was an emergency physician who fell, broke his leg, hiked for 5 miles through the wilderness using his bike as a crutch before he could call out to get help. The ambulance came and only had nitrous oxide, laughing gas, or pain medication. So he designed a study and carried it out, and now ketamine is being used in ambulances to treat acute pain.
Wow.
By nasal sprayer. So you can give it by nasal spray, and the absorption is about 50%. When we're talking about use in for treatment-resistant depression, people are going to be using the nasal inhaler, which is the approved form in the States. But I'm also seeing some sublingual usage with sublingual troches, or what would you call it?
Like a lozenge.
A lozenge, that's the right word for it, yeah. So that's at this conference I was at, there was a pharmacist there who's 3D printing ketamine lozenges for psychiatrists to give patients.
I need one of those.
Treatment-resistant depression. So pretty advanced stuff.
Wow, that's really cool. Just a little more on ketamine. Now, when we start putting it in creams for neuropathic pain, we use it because it's an NMDA receptor antagonist, and you know, a lot of other analgesics can get at the NMDA receptor. But our local anesthetist got very excited because apparently there's a whole bunch of safety protocols they've got to use when they use ketamine as an anesthetic. Can you just tell the audience why the anesthetists are, were a little concerned about using ketamine for just run-of-the-mill pain and how we avoid some of those problems if we're doing it for depression, spraying it up people's noses?
Yeah, there's a kind of, it's a bit of a turf war kind of thing, and anesthetists are very protective of it. But ketamine is one of the safest medications around. It's used in battlefield medicine. You can give it to someone on the battlefield and chop off their leg and do that surgery. So the concerns are mostly overblown. There's a lot of regulatory stuff involved, and just because it's an anesthetic. But what we're talking about here is using it in sub-anesthetic doses. And there's lots of good data, and there's now FDA data from Spravato saying that you can do this and do it in a safe manner. The concerns may become a little bit about abuse. Obviously, you don't want these sprayers going missing. You know, ketamine is known to be a drug of abuse as well. But it's realistically safer than, you know, all the narcotics we're using. So I'm not sure what the huge issue is.
Well, thank you. This has been a really fascinating sidetrack away from cannabis.
But you did ask me about the mechanism.
Tell me about the mechanism.
So there's this weird thing in depression where parts of your brain are less electrically active than normal. So they're just kind of, I would say, electrically silent, quiet brain areas. And when you take ketamine, within a couple of hours, you start to get a growth of synapses and dendrites off your neurons. So you get not new neurons, but get more connectivity, and those areas of your brain light up again.
Are you telling me
and that
you're
happens,
treating depression in a couple hours as opposed to
weeks? So that's the whole thing about ketamine is it will fix depression within a couple of hours, and the effects last after a week.
So one dose of ketamine in a couple hours, I feel better, and my depression is left for a week.
And so suicidality, this is infusion data study, but one infusion can fix 30% of suicidality within the several hours. Two infusions can fix 60% of suicidality
that's
within
crazy.
Hours. So
I don't remember
this is a whole new
but that
treatment
sounds
coming in.
Like an electroconvulsive therapy too, doesn't it?
Well, the thing is, you don't have to do it that way. You can just do it IV, and people just sit there and chill, and they're fine. They don't need to go for electroshock therapy, which, you know, honestly isn't available to us anyway. What I would love to do is have the ability to give people intranasal ketamine who are suicidal in my emergency department, so they don't have to lock them up in a room without their phone and clothes and any natural light, because that doesn't tend to improve their mood much.
No, I imagine not. And I'm jumping all over the place, but that reminded me of something else in your talk. Back to gabapentin. You were talking about gabapentin and suicidal ideation, especially in young people. We'll call it 15 to 24-ish. I had never heard that before. That's a thing, because, frankly, we have lots of, say, teenage girls with migraines who periodically get gabapentin. Is that,
yes.
Is that so a bigger concern than I... something I should be aware of?
It is probably something you should be aware of. This comes from a recent Swedish study, I think published earlier this year. There should be a link in my thing to it. But if you look up, it was a paper on gabapentinoids on suicidal behavior and driving impairment, which they also found with gabapentin. So I don't know how often you counsel your patients about the driving impairment.
But the suicide has never come up.
But suicide, yeah, and they found it was more common in younger people. And this is precisely the people at CMAJ warn, you know, they've got developing brains and they shouldn't be exposed to cannabis.
Right.
But apparently gabapentin is just fine. So I don't know, you know, how, again, it just goes to double standard and the stigma involved in cannabis.
Wow. So much to learn. Now, we are running short on time. So before I forget, is there anything else, cannabis or otherwise, that you think our audience should know before I let you go?
I'm going to say that to people, if you're on gabapentin and it's working for you, great. If it's not working for you, it is associated with withdrawal symptoms. So, you know, a lot of people just take medications because they've been on them for a long time. So if you're on, say, 900 milligrams of gabapentin, look at going off it or decreasing the dose to 600 for a couple of weeks, decrease it down to 300. Keep track of what those changes, how those changes make you feel. And if you don't notice any difference, then why would you keep taking a medication that has known side effects?
I think that's great advice. Dr. Mitchell, that was great. Thank you very much for being on Reefer Mendes. We really enjoyed talking with you.
All right, no problem. I'm happy to come back anytime to talk about ketamine, cannabis, or whatever.
You know, Trevor, I liked that conversation. Now maybe people will understand why I was so excited at the start of the interview and bashed Gabby's.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think you definitely have an ally in Dr. Mitchell for your anti-gabapentin rant. No, and he even said, so, you know, if you are taking gabapentin today and it is working for you today,
yes.
Don't throw them out the window. No. That's not what we're saying.
No.
But, and don't get us in trouble with our colleges, but if you are on it today and maybe it's not working, again, don't throw them out the window. Maybe it's time to have a conversation with your doctor, with your pharmacist, with your healthcare practitioner about, I'm not sure these are working for me. There may be some side effects. You know, maybe we should try something else.
Another part of my practice is that I have the opportunity to work in the Manitoba Corrections, and I do nurse in corrections in jails.
Yeah, I've seen faxes from you in my pharmacy.
Yes, actually, that is very true. So I will tell you that in our jail, our doctor who prescribes there does not prescribe Gabby's in jails. So people that are incarcerated.
So do you have a lot of withdrawal? Because that came up in the interview.
You know, it's tough. I haven't seen it. I'm not saying it's not there. But I will tell you that when the inmates come in for their medical assessment, because we assess every inmate that comes into the institution, they are seen by a nurse, blood pressure, weight, history is taken so that we can anticipate any concerns. I will tell you that gabapentin's is a very popular, very asked for medication in the jail systems. And I will say that our doctor does not prescribe it. And I can tell you that the individuals that I'm telling you won't get Gabby's here, they are very disappointed. And one of the reasons why it's not given, it's not because the doctor doesn't care, it's because of how it's abused, right? People are snorting Gabby's now.
Yeah, and I don't want to give the impression that, you know, gabapentin somehow makes you criminal. The reason so many people you see in the correction system are on gabapentins is because so many people in the general population are on gabapentin.
Oh, sure,
it's just a really common medication.
But it's also an abused drug.
It is, yes.
You know? And no offense to our inmates, but a lot of those people have social economic issues that make them susceptible to abuse. And we don't do it, and we don't give it in the jail. You have your paper up. You want to do a quote?
I do. There was a couple of nice quotes from there. First was, and you'll love this one, the whole gabapentin marketing scheme was supported by a criminal enterprise.
I love it. Like, once again, Trevor, Gabby's parallel cannabis, in the sense that, you know, everyone talks about we got to get legalized cannabis so we get the criminal element out of it. Meanwhile, on the other side of the street, the legal side of the street, Gabby's is got criminal. That quote.
Criminal enterprise. So, yes. So that leads well into, so a criticism of the CMA, the Canadian Medical Association, is, you know, you guys keep saying cannabis cures everything. Kirk, what do we say about gabapentin? It cures everything?
It cures everything. Yeah, it's smarties, right? No, I think what I said, I've already said what I said about Gabby's, it's used incorrectly, it's used off-label, it's used all the time, and it's an argument for positive people to say, let's try cannabis.
Yeah, no.
Instead.
It seems, you know, we're not going to change this overnight. And again, don't throw your gabapentins out if you're on them right now. But maybe there is another way for our neuropathic pain.
As a health professional, I'm a registered nurse, so I have to be careful what I say. I'm not encouraging people to go out and dumping the gabbies. I'm not saying that. What I'm trying to say is that be aware. Just be aware that there is history behind a lot of the medications that you take. We're using gabapentins as an example right now. Talk to your pharmacist. Talk to your doctor. Ask critical questions. Get them to listen to this podcast so that they know the reference that, you know, that we're making. And, you know, we've been doing this podcast now for 2 years. And in these 2 years, we have met lots of people who share our curiosity with cannabis, right? So this is a canna-positive podcast. Why is it a canna-positive podcast?
On this one in particular?
No, this, like what we're doing in Reefer Madness, we're canna-positive Why?
Because everybody we talk to seems to have something else good to say about how cannabis is helping people.
But we've also gone out of our way to find people who have had difficulties. We interviewed the Canadian Federation of Independent Businesses because they had this provocative headline that, you know, Canadian businesses are still having problems with cannabis after years legalization. As you get deep into the interview, you find that
Maybe not that many problems.
But there's still 10,000 businesses having, so there are issues. But it's not that. So this is a plug for Reefer Madness. If you have a story out there that you want us to tell, can a positive or not positive, get a hold of us at info@reefermed.ca.
Yeah.
Right? We are looking for canna stories. We're,
canna stories?
Canna stories.
Used to be called My Cannabis Story, but yeah, that's good too.
Let's talk about My Cannabis Stories.
Oh yeah. No, these are just stories from people out there. This is, you use cannabis and it helped you. You use cannabis and it hurt you. You use cannabis for an interesting way, interesting condition. We love hearing the stories, and our audience loves hearing the stories from regular people about how cannabis is affecting their lives.
And we are looking for stories that aren't positive about cannabis. If you are a researcher and you have a concern, we interviewed the guys out of Arkansas who...
Yeah, they were feeding CBD to mice and...
In the livers.
And finding out how CBD is affecting livers, which might affect other drugs. Research was still early, but they are literally doing toxicology experiments, so they are looking for the bad parts of cannabis.
Yeah, so we as Reefer Madness, we're trying to tell stories. Don't blame us if all of a sudden we find a canna positive story and we can bash Gavin Madness. Any opportunity to bash Gavin
Madness. Kirk is just grinning ear to ear.
Thank you, Dr. Mitchell. I enjoyed that conversation.
On that, I think Renee has a special thing that he's dug up for the music for this episode.
Well, thanks, guys. Yeah, with all this talk about Gabba Gabba, it just reminded me instantly of the Ramones. And of course, we try to play music that is Dauphin-centric. Well, the Ramones were close to Dauphin once, June 5th, 1983. They were at the Playhouse Theater in Winnipeg. And I can only imagine that they had really wished they could have played in Dauphin. So I'm going to go with that. The song is Pinhead by the Ramones because Gabba Gabba reminded me of them.
That's really, really good. So
that was another good one. And
so Gabba Gabba High?
Gabba Gabba High. Punk rock rules, man.
Like the show? Let us know. We're Reefer Madness on Instagram and Facebook, at Reefer Madness on Twitter, or head over to the website at reefermed.ca to find out what we're all about and what's coming up next. Gabba Gabba Weed.
Gabba Gabba High.
Yeah.
Gabba Gabba High.
Gabba Gabba High.